In this edition of Audio Berkman.
And do we need a PBS of the internet? Do we need a space that is set aside for non-commercial interests? And do we need funding from the government or other third-party sources where people can produce material and media on the internet that is really high-quality educational production?
Susie Lindsay discusses television in transition, public interest values, and a shifting media landscape. Susie Lindsay is a research fellow at the Berkman Center, working on the Digital Media Project. Her research interests include communications law, mass media law, and the impact of the transition from analog to digital media on artists, consumers, and the media industries. She writes, "In the shifting media landscape, as broadcast and the internet merge, what are the public interest values and how do we achieve them?" We'll hear Susie speaking at a Berkman Tuesday luncheon, July 11th, 2006. Audio Berkman is brought to you by the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. For Audio Berkman, I'm Colin Reinsman.
So, television has been an interest of mine for a long time, and I'm delighted you guys are here and willing to give me some time and insight and your ideas on some of these issues. I, in kind of a peon level, have worked in commercial local television station for a nonprofit organization that created documentaries for PBS, for Yahoo.ca, and for the Canadian Radio Television Telecommunications Commission, which is Canada's FCC, sort of. Anyway, so this is an amalgamation of a lot of the issues that sort of cross the commercial, public interest, and regulatory sector. And I'm also delighted that Steve is here, and we're working together. Colin mentioned a couple times the Beyond Broadcast Conference, which Dean and Colin Rinesmith and Steve, Jake Shapiro, and a number of our friends from New York and D.C. all worked to put together. And the thesis of the conference was that public interest media, the traditional forms PBS and the PEG access channels that Daniel and Jason work so hard at, are in this sort of unique opportunity to embrace a lot of the social media that's developing. And we wanted to explore what they could do to make public media more vibrant and robust and vital. And coming off the energy of that conference, Steve and I are working on a paper. So we want to present to you some of the ideas that we've developed and hope to get some background and insight feedback on them. So this is a quote from current FCC Commissioner Michael J. Copps talking about how media is a special industry. This is sort of the place where we start. And in the paper, we go through three phases. One is what public interest obligations exist in the broadcast age. What are the public interest values in the audio and video media on the internet, in the internet age? And then how these two medias interact. How do they affect each other? So those are the three stages I'm going to take you through. Starting with television, I've broken television down into three eras. The first one, the early stage of over-the-air. The FCC was given the mandate by Congress to regulate the valuable public airwaves with the interest of public interest, convenience, and necessity. And it was up to the FCC to decide what that meant. Through a number of decisions and developing over time, localism, diversity, and universalism were really the fundamental prevailing values. And we saw come out of the FCC the Fairness Doctrine, which required stations or any programming that was going to do a show that was at all controversial had to air both sides of the controversy or all sides of the controversy. We saw the financial syndication rules, which required broadcasters like NBC to limit the production that they did in-house to 3 hours a day. And they had to purchase their production outside to try and... That was an effort to create an independent production industry and avoid the vertical integration. And we also saw ownership regulations. And to avoid concentration of ownership, the FCC cut up the U.S. into various markets and designated how many stations a particular company could own for radio and television in certain markets. And then we moved to the next stage where cable started to become prevalent and people started subscribing to cable, and the FCC became consumed with how to regulate the relationship between cable and over-the-air, these competing forms of distribution. And we saw on this stage the must carry retransmission rules, where the cable companies must carry a small local station, and if they want to carry the Big Bang, NBC, CBS, they must give some compensation for the privilege of providing that. But also at this stage, with cable moving in, moving out across the country, there developed the public access community channels. And this was, cable was required to negotiate with each municipality a franchise fee they would pay, and it was up to the municipality to decide how they were going to spend that money on public education and government channels. And the main theory behind this was to increase community and increase access so that individuals could have a soapbox. They could go and learn, go to their community center, learn how to use a camera, put together a production, and have their chance to have their voice heard. And that those are the PEG community access channels. And the second thing that happened around this stage was President Lyndon Johnson signed the Corporation for Public Broadcasting Act in 1967. And PBS went to air in 1970. And this was a push for educational, high-quality programming and programming for children, and also a need for non-commercial in this context. So there were heavy restrictions where PBS wasn't allowed to receive advertising money, but they could take some underwriting, and there's sort of a definitional distinction that they created on this. And then the third stage, vaguely sort of put, is the internet stage, which is where we are now. Innovation, competition, and democracy is sort of the now prevailing values the FCC focuses on. That's not to say they didn't exist in the over-the-air era. They absolutely did. And it was really around the early 80s when Commissioner Mark Fowler started talking about television being a toaster with pictures, and they started rolling back. So there's no financial syndication rules. There's no fairness doctrine, and the ownership regulations have been lessened. And this was all to increase competition or encourage competition and innovation. And those were the prevailing public interest values. So if we look at, this is sort of a list of some of the things that the FCC has focused on and tried to encourage through broadcast regulation. And the three ways of getting this, sort of as a recap, are the trusteeship model with commercial broadcasters, and this is the regulations placed on broadcasters. I'm going to play a little.
Gentlemen, your trust accounting with your beneficiaries is long overdue. Never have so few owed so much to so many. Why is so much of television so bad? I've heard many answers. Demands of your advertisers, competition for ever higher ratings, the need always to attract a mass audience, the high cost of television programs, the insatiable appetite for programming material. These are some of the reasons.
Okay, that was Chairman Newton Minow in 1961. Believe it or not, many of you can make your own decision as to whether how relevant you think that is today. But this is the model of the airwaves being scarce, and in return for this valuable resource, the commercial broadcasters must provide some form of public interest. And it's everyone's decision on their own whether they think they are succeeding in doing that. The Public Broadcasting Service and Corporation for Public Broadcasting, again, this is the focus on excellence in programming, education and children's programming, and non-commercial. And I think they've been fairly successful in achieving those public interests, but not as successful in achieving local diversity, minority representation, and access and reaching out to their audience, being representative of the population. So PBS has achieved some and not all. And then the public educational government channels, which have been really strong in community and access, and sorry guys, not quite as strong in the excellence in programming and other things. So those are the ways in which we've tried to achieve some of these public interest values in the broadcast age. So now we move to the internet age, and I have another little.
Eventually, I think this electronic knowledge bank could be as valuable as the Federal Reserve Bank. And such a system could involve other nations. It could involve them in a partnership to share knowledge and to thus enrich all mankind. A wild and visionary idea? Not at all. Yesterday's strangest dream are today's headlines.
Okay, so I think this quote is relevant today as we move forward into new technologies in the internet. But what's interesting is it's President Lyndon Johnson in 1967 when he was signing the Corporation for Public Broadcasting Act. So what's happening in this internet age? I'm a huge fan of Yochai Benkler's book, The Wealth of Networks, which I encourage everyone to look at. And he makes three observations of new things happening here. And one is non-proprietary systems. Examples would be Linux. Non-market production. We have, for the first time, people spending hours and hours producing blogs, podcasts, video blogs, and they're not getting paid for it, and they're not making any money off of it. And we have a rise of large-scale cooperative efforts, the flagship, in my mind, being Wikipedia. And so if we look at the various interests and how they are achieved on the internet, it doesn't seem like you have to work very hard to find examples of innovation, competition, diversity. We have new forms of community, Facebook, MySpace, Flickr, listenup.org. We have localism and local blogs and people, community centers having websites. We have non-commercial production. People have more access, more participation, ability to operate autonomously and develop their own identity and their own web page, their own home page, their own blog, and sort of have their voice heard. Under the diversity, I should say, there are issues of digital divide, absolutely, that don't exist in broadcast. But to compare it with the amount of access people have and the opportunity to have their voice heard in the internet compared with mass media, it's the architecture itself is set up in a way to sort of allow these things to happen. Which leads us to, in order to sort of achieve or maintain these values, what do we need to do? And do we need a PBS of the internet? Do we need a space that is set aside for non-commercial interests? And do we need funding from the government or other third-party sources where people can produce material and media on the internet that is really high-quality educational production? Or are we okay if we can succeed in having a platform that has an open pipe, in other words, that is network neutral? We have a balanced copyright system where there's not massive concerns about chilling effects. And we have some sort of funding mechanism where people can have access to digicams or some way of, or podcasts in some way of being able to create their own media. And is that enough? So that's one question that we have in our second section in terms of what public interest media on the internet age and what's happening. And now we move to our third section, which is how the two media interact. And here we have sort of two opposite viewpoints, one being that mass media is on its way out, it's a dinosaur and it will die, and then the other viewpoint that they don't die, they don't replace each other, they just exist, they just coexist. So examples of one-to-many and many-to-many, we have public insight journalism and radio open source. These are two radio examples of radio production that involve their viewers or listeners in the production of their show. So Radio Open Source has developed a community around its blog, Public Insight Journalism on America's Public Media, solicits input from their listeners and tries to get as much information, believing that their listeners know just as much, if not more, about any given topic than the radio producers. And these are two examples of ways of trying to use new social media to create a mass media product. YouTube, NBC, Gooba, and Warner Brothers. So everyone's pretty familiar with a lot of the online video services. You can upload your own home videos. And some of the problems they've caused for the larger commercial broadcasters in terms of distributing some of their product. About a week or two ago, some big announcements came from these companies saying that YouTube is now going to promote NBC. They'll have the blessing of NBC to distribute some of their clips. And in return, NBC will promote YouTube on TV and do contests where people can upload their own videos to YouTube and the best one will be aired on NBC. And Gooba and Warner Brothers has a similar thing. Gooba is also a service where people can upload their own video. So this is an example of these two formats, the social media and the mass media, merging and working together. The War Tapes. This is a particular favorite of mine. We aired at the Beyond Broadcast conference. And I'm going to show you a clip from the trailer. It is in theaters now, so you guys can see it if you want. The cool thing about this video is the director and producer had sufficient funding to go to Iraq to make a movie, but they instead chose not to and to give cameras to the soldiers, and they directed you by IM from Vermont.
This is Sergeant Stephen Page, Specialist Michael Moriarty. Is that really want to go? Probably not.
I'm not supposed to talk to the media.
I'm not the media, damn it.
The day is here. Life will change.
The real deal, man.
You ready?
Bring it on.
You ready? Iraq, here we come.
Every soldier eventually wants to go in combat. That's a natural instinct.
If you let fear get to you, then you may not be doing your job.
Every single time you go out there, there's attacks. It's unbelievable.
Hey, Pastor, your ass crack is right in my face.
Keep going, brother. You want to play?
That's really hard for him to not have his dad.
This little kid is in the middle of a war zone.
In the beginning, he's like, write something dirty.
The world needs democracy.
The whole thing is on the app. It's a long bit. So
hey, Susie, it's at Kendall right now, so if anyone wants to watch it, it's actually in town.
Awesome. Thanks, Dean. That's an example of a mass media product using new social media tools in their production. Mm-hmm. And Current TV, another example that I like. Of course, I don't get to watch it because I don't have cable, but It's a cable channel that gives instructions. You can see here their viewer-created content page. You can get instructions how to make a video, upload it, and then they air certain videos on their cable channel. And this one difference with Current, it's Al Gore's channel, is that it was developed with this theory in mind, to try and use social media, as opposed to trying to make the transition. It sort of grew up with these concepts. And we get to our questions. So these are the questions we are wondering. Are the new technologies fulfilling the public interest element we have fought so hard to achieve, making the regulatory structure obsolete? Is our existing regulatory structure fundamentally ill-suited for a media landscape affected by the internet? Is it that everything new is old again? And are we faced with a gatekeeper with new clothing? So I would love... And yeah, Stephen, I would love your input on either thoughts of anything that we've presented or any of these questions.
Yeah, thoughts on questions, if we missed something, if you think we're wrong somewhere, we'd love you to prove us wrong before we write it down in paper. thoughts or questions?
My question is, you said that PBS wasn't originally doing very well with the minority representation. How do you feel the internet is doing?
I think that's a good question. I think that I don't have statistics. My instinct would be that there is absolutely a digital divide, and it is among racial more than gender, I think, and definitely socioeconomic split. But I would like to think that it's better. It doesn't mean that it's doing a good job, but I think that there's more diversity on the internet in terms of racial diversity than there is on PBS, I think. But that's a bit of a subjective viewpoint at this point without having data on that.
And I think Ethan Zuckerman's project here at the Berkman Center, Global Voices, Ethan has a lot more data on that, and probably most of the people here are familiar with this project, but the basic idea is to help unite bloggers, not only from across the country, but mostly from around the world, to help bring together all of these sort of disparate small blogs that may exist here and there, and really brand it and bring together the best of the content and get more exposure from people who are traditionally on the other side of that digital divide. So I think that there is a reality of where the internet is at right now, and there are some great success stories. And then there's a huge amount of potential on the other side of that. So if we ask a question like, do we need a PBS of the internet, or do we need some sort of platform that helps people cross the barriers that currently exist in the internet? We can really ask, you know, in what ways can we address that public interest need for diversity, multiplicity of voices, and things like that? So the internet isn't sort of a silver bullet that's going to work perfectly, but it seems to be pretty well suited for addressing those issues. And part of what we're trying to figure out is what kind of regulations or funding or other policy decisions would make sense to help encourage it, because it is well positioned.
It's pretty interesting, actually, that you're already asking the question about, do we need a PBS in the internet? It's sort of foreshadowing what seems like is eventually going to happen anyway. I mean, PBS was created as an alternative to commercial mainstream media. And it, from that question, it sort of implies that, you know, that's ultimately where the internet is headed. So it's interesting, because, I mean, right now we don't seem like, I mean, to me, it seems like we don't need a public broadcasting, a PBS model for the internet, because we have network neutrality. If we, in the future, don't have an internet that's neutral, and we find more partnerships between YouTube and NBC and models like that, then I think the conversation will be necessary. But it's interesting that you sort of bring that up. I'm curious where that sort of comes from.
Yeah, I think one way that we've been looking at this is in the context of sort of historically, when has the government decided that regulation is necessary? And it's been in the context of scarcity, in terms of spectrum scarcity. It's been in the context of market failure around either access or quality of content. And it's been some other slightly more squishy cultural issues about what is in the interest of the public and free society. And so when we're thinking about questions like, do we need a PBS of the internet, we're asking, in a way, we're asking, well, is there scarcity? Is there scarcity of spectrum on the internet? Well, maybe if some regulations change that, and, you know, network neutrality relates to that. Is there a market failure? Well, we can point to a lot of good examples of things that are in the public interest right now that have emerged organically out of the internet. You know, Wikipedia is sort of one of the big examples that people use, but there's a wide variety of commercial or non-commercial things that are serving some of the same educational, informative roles. In fact, you know, when you hear Johnson's comments from 67 talking about the massive electronic database that unites nations and gives students in a small town access to a large library, it sounds remarkably like the internet. But the internet didn't come out of a public broadcasting act. It came out sort of organically. So we're not sure if we need a PBS of the internet, or if we need to just somehow encourage that to happen organically some other way.
When people talk about economics and they talk about computing economic systems, they'll, for example, if they want to talk about capitalism, they'll talk about a system that is truly capitalist, you know, works on these principles, and what determines whether or not it's effective is, you know, efficient delivery of goods and services that meets such and such criteria. And so I think behind this presentation, there's also the question of what would be the ideal public media itself, or what are the functions that we are trying to serve? For example, would it be daily coverage of local and international events that's accessible? Like, what would be the criteria that you want to judge by? Because I think that would be an effective way of determining whether or not what we've got is well suited. Like, the problem with, you can go back to the question of, well, why weren't the giants working before? It wasn't just that they didn't involve participatory culture or participatory tools, is that people felt they were fundamentally flawed on another level. But, you know, other people will point to the fact that, oh, with new forms of citizen media, there are actually certain functions that are not being fulfilled, like investigative journalism. No one's been able to show them a highly distributed way that people are going to be able to have the protections that journalists have, or that they're going to be able to get information quite the same way. So I'm wondering if maybe distilling it down by the functions that we expect media to play, and then evaluating the potential of both the large model that we know and the participatory models that we know we can point out both the voids and this potential for synthesis.
I was going to say, sort of to follow up more why we regulate or why we need a PBS of the internet or don't need it. The first Communications Act, from what I understand, is 1934, and PBS came in 1967 and officially on air in 1970. That's a large gap. They decided, Congress decided to follow the model of having commercial broadcasters that had public interest obligations, and that wasn't succeeding terribly well, and they decided they needed a non-commercial alternative. I mean, that's a huge length of time before that developed, and one of the reasons why the internet has had so much competition, innovation, diversity, and everything is because Congress initially took a hands off the internet. Let's not touch it and see what happens. So it's a little bit of a wait and see where this goes and what develops.
If, say we just don't do an internet PBS, what are the ways that a non-commercial entity could survive without turning to advertising models and other things like that?
That's a good question. I think that the example that always comes to mind is a Wikipedia and independent funding like the Internet Archive and organizations that have We Media that go off of funding. I guess it's sort of going back to the Ford and MacArthur and those models. But I think one of the most fascinating questions in this area is where the non-commercial, commercial, public interest divide is. And in a broadcast model where production is so expensive, the only people who can really produce high-quality production need a lot of money, and it tends to be big corporations that have access to it. In the internet model, it's much less expensive to produce things. And there's a question of sort of how much money is required, and we can look at various communities online, like Flickr, MySpace, Facebook, and wonder, they are providing some sort of public service, but they are commercial. They're selling advertising space. So is the line so clear in this context, and how do we decide where commercial ends and where public interest begins?
But PBS also has not advertising for commercial companies, so...
Yeah, and that's being relaxed sort of more and more, too. So yes, it does receive corporate sponsorship through underwriting. They try and make a distinction in that regard and try and limit it.
But the distinction would be much bigger if it was just underwriting. It's not just underwriting. They literally have commercials that are non-commercial, commercial. They're everywhere.
Yeah, that's because they keep relaxing the obligations. Another thing I thought of is when we ask sort of why we regulate, back to what Steve was going with this, again, the airwaves were considered public space, and so that's where this obligation came. If you're going to use the public parks to make money, you have to provide something. If you're going to use the public airwaves to make money, you have to provide something. And there's that element of reason to regulate. And then there's this sort of squishy cultural thing. The media, like the quote from Commissioner Copps at the first slide, is important. It is something different. It is special. And how does that fit in the internet? Like, can we say that by telcos and cable companies using the ground that we all sort of collectively own to put in their pipes, does that mean that they owe some obligation? Or can we just rely on this squishy cultural thing that it's important that we have high-quality information and high-quality programming, and therefore we can justify having some sort of creation of a PBS on the internet?
I'd like to ask a question from the perspective of question one, at least the way I understand it. And it might be provocative, and I'm very curious about your responses and your counter-arguments to that. But couldn't we also argue that we should consider abolishing PBS because we have the internet now and we have ad-free access and every peer production of public interest groups, etc.?
I think that's a great question. I think that... to add to that, there's some people who question when you have 500 channels on cable and you've got the History Channel and the Discovery Channel and they're doing educational documentaries, is it necessary for the government to be funding? But I think that's a subjective question, how important you think the programming that PBS produces is. I have a bias towards some of their the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer and Frontline and some of these programs that I think are pretty strong. But I think that's a really important question to ask.
Yeah. I would also add that, you know, one of the we sort of mapped out the public interest values that we think the internet is well suited to fulfill, and at least for the moment, one of those is not universalism, which is in the Telecommunications Act, universal service is this idea that anyone has access to the media, and that it's at least relatively low cost, and the concept of universal service drove build-out requirements for broadcasters so that they had to serve small, non-profitable communities for them as well as the highly profitable large communities. And right now, the internet does not have universal service. A lot of people don't have access to it. And so although it's fulfilling some of these same roles and filling some of the public interest obligations that something like public broadcasting has traditionally served, everyone doesn't have access yet. In addition, the production values or the excellence of the programming, if you want to use the terms from the early days of television broadcasts, hasn't yet reached the point where it's of the same quality as what's on those legacy systems. So I think, you know, 20 years down the line or 10 years down the line, maybe the answer will be yes. PBS as a model is outmoded, or, you know, the idea of a corporation for public broadcasting, which is funding primarily broadcasting versus internet and interactive ventures, you know, will become an even more relevant question. But what will be interesting, I think, in the meantime, is to see how the internet reshapes the way that those existing broadcast forms function. And so that's why I think that the sort of third section that Susie talked about, what happens when this one-to-many meets the many-to-many model, is a really interesting question, because we don't know yet. Will TV be reshaped in such a way so that NBC is airing a lot more user-created content through its huge broadcast bullhorn and better representing a diversity of voices than it ever could have if it were simply a one-way hierarchical model? It's hard to know. It's exciting to see some of those examples of that in action, though. So I think it's a very relevant question. One of the things that I think Susie and I are most interested in is how can we encourage, in this time of transition, how can we encourage the new forms that are emerging to promote public interest as best as possible, so that at some point we could ask the question whether or not those old structures make sense. Very long answer to your question, but
may
you have a follow-up?
Respond quickly?
Yeah, sure.
Just a very suggestive question, but let's say you're a government agency, the FCC, you have $100 million to spend for the public interest in the internet bill. What would you do? Would you enable would you start a program of giving poor Americans access to the internet, or would you start an internet PBS? I think that's...
It's a great question.
Very relevant question.
We should ask, we should make note of that. I mean, I have my own opinion on that.
But I would do the access and give people access to the internet and give them cameras and give them video tape recorders, video recorders, so that they can create their own media.
Yeah.
I like the way you phrase that.
Yeah. I think an exciting thing about the internet is across the board it seems to lower the barrier to access, and so the amount of resources required, governmental or regulatory or whatever, to overcome those barriers is reduced. So it may very well be that if you compare, you know, what would it take to fund another high production value large-scale organization versus to give access and to invest in projects that are really capitalizing on those lowered barriers and those new modes of production, it might be that the latter is a much better investment from a financial standpoint and really achieves a lot more of those public interest values.
Colin just pointed out that Daniel and Jason work at PEG, and essentially that's the model that was tried to that was applied in the broadcast context. I don't know if you guys have any comment on that, but that's essentially what the theory behind the the PEG access channels is, right? To give, to put cameras in the hands of people in the community and allow them to produce their own product.
Yeah, and I would say if you ask the, we call ourselves community media now, community media centers. We've tried to kind of break free from the shackles of traditional cable, cast, television, because we also realize the limitations on the one-to-many. If you're trying to engage community and civic dialogue about local government and you're trying to get disenfranchised people the ability to communicate with the not-so-disenfranchised, we found that television just wasn't enough. So, I mean, over the last 30 years, with around 100 million to 1 billion, the numbers are all over the place, worth of public reinvestment through regulatory structure, we've tried to create that model that you're talking about. Now, we just got done with a conference where I would say 40 to 50% of the people were debating whether that was a successful regulatory model and a successful public interest media experiment. So I don't really want to comment on that. But the thing that I do want to comment on is what Steve was talking about with build-out provisions. I do think if I was going to spend $100 million through the federal government to connect people, I would not only, I would provide the power for local municipalities to force internet providers like AT&T and Verizon to build out into all communities. And I would include as a component of that nodes or hot centers or, you know, like Ethan Zuckerman, his Geek Core kind of project, where you build these hot spots of connectivity that can physically, face-to-face, help people get access to the internet and the tools to create media. I don't know if you want to edit it.
That was great. I guess sort of similar. I wonder, with television, with radio, I could be way off, but I assume that there were either government-mandated or marketplace-mandated standards for transmission, such that a radio I bought 40 years ago or a television I bought 20 years ago can still receive the same signals over the air. And so the idea of equipping people to receive, at least, if not to create, works because there can be, you know, it's so cheap because there is that market for equipment and there are standards. But on the internet, not only is the pace of innovation such that it's difficult to equip people with the equipment they'll need to use it because it changes so rapidly and they need to constantly upgrade, but the standards themselves are so constantly shifting that creating audio or video or other types of content today, you may not be able to read it or listen to it or see it in just a few years. Do you think there's a place for the FCC or for regulation in terms of trying to figure out this sort of standards mess or to come up with formats or settings that are not patented or not or whatever, such that there can be more open access in that way?
That's a really great question. The FCC setting standards, I find, makes me a little uncomfortable in this context, mainly because of what you said about innovation and it changing so quickly. I'm optimistic or hopeful. It's not an area I've actually spent a lot of time thinking about in terms of how standards could be applied or regulated, but that media innovation would continue to improve and improve in a way that would allow all forms of media to still be played, in the sense that they would a new standard of watching video would be so innovative it would be able to show all the old formats as well. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I would just say that, you know, that
that's,
you could worry
is that
about
too hopeful?
That, well, just the patent concern, the concern that all this stuff is intellectual property.
Oh.
Because there isn't an open standard for this is how we broadcast, because you have to use either Real Player or Windows or...
Yeah, a great example
yeah,
of that is the NPR archives on their website right now are in Real Player format. Now, NPR has a lot of that stuff stored, and they could re-encode it and all of that. Of course, that's a huge project for them. But yeah, that's exactly the question you're asking. Is it in the public interest to have all of the public broadcasting from the past however many years in a proprietary video format? Probably not. I think an interesting efforts in that area are projects like the Internet Archive, which isn't a standard setting body, but it is an open library which encourages certain standards for the things that it stores.
Open standards, non-proprietary.
So, it would be interesting to look at how the model of something like the Internet Archive could be extended. Of course, that's another interesting example of a non-governmental, non-regulated, a privately funded, philanthropically funded thing is stepping up in one of those public interest roles.
That's really useful, because one of the things Steve and I are trying to do is come up with an idea of what some of the values that apply specifically to the Internet are, and I think non-proprietary and openness could possibly be added to that list in terms of if we want to have go for not the PBS of the Internet model, but the second one with the platform. Perhaps one of the things in order to make that platform exist in addition to network neutrality and a balanced copyright and some funding mechanism would be an openness non-proprietary system. If that...
Can I jump in on that? So I think... Could you go back to that list?
Oh, yeah.
I think it's really interesting to break down, instead of saying PBS or not PBS, to think in a more nuanced way about what are the goals that... Maybe go up one for the goals of regulatory stuff. So to see if these are the same goals that we have, or if there are any additional goals, if we want to get rid of any, because we're not worried about them, what the current system is addressing or not addressing, and then what are kinds of different mechanisms for addressing each of them. Whereas to say PBS or not PBS seems like a very blunt instrument. And it may be that, as Amanda pointed out, that within the area of investigative journalism, there's a real need for funding or for an entity or for some other, for some body, for some sort of, more invasive way to achieve certain more narrowly prescribed goals. And then it may be the case that some of these other goals we're not really worried about, in the same way that, it has been argued that HBO and History Channel and these other organizations do a better job with NPR-style programming than NPR, or than, I'm sorry, PBS-style programming than PBS does. Maybe that's, no longer a concern. But to kind of parse it a little more narrowly and to be more targeted rather than saying, here we need to deal with all access issues, or maybe we need to deal with just minority communities and just the skills or just the hardware or just the whatever. So that's one point. And then the other point other question I had is, I guess it goes to the third question that you ended with, is what have we learned from other experiences? If radio, as Danny pointed out, started out as a kind of one-to-one, bi-directional medium, and then quickly became a mostly commercial space, is there something that we learned, that we could have done to stop that from happening? I mean, television and radio are slightly different, for sure, but are there things that in other spaces that we have faced these same problems where we might not take the same path, but we could at least learn from those lessons?
I think,
yeah,
that's a great question.
This is a great topic, and thank you for the presentations today. I don't think you probably intended to do this, but you've convinced me today that using TV and radio as a model for looking at the regulation of the internet, you reached the end of the road very quickly, and that you probably need to look for other parallels. And I mean, to be kind of trite about it, the television was a magazine rack, whereas the internet is a library, and the regulatory tools and approaches will be vastly different, obviously. I mean, in the TV age, you kind of, I guess, two things to look at. One was content and the other one was access. And those are going to be resolved in many different ways on the internet, but you have a whole host of different things. I mean, the question about PBS might become irrelevant as it's just washed out in a sea of information, and the question of keeping it going may become irrelevant. Whether you fund it or not, you can't make people watch it. And just to return to the library question again, is that, I mean, another regulatory question might be not only access, but kind of effective access to a diversity of issues might be a very important issue in the future. Do you have a librarian who's making sure that people are seeing the good quality content amongst the sea of content? How do you approach that?
Let's get one here.
I'm
little primitive, but I'm a little confused. First of all, when you say that not everybody has access to internet, I said there were plenty of free dial-ups, and most people in America has telephones. So I'm a little confused, why is it an access issue? You're talking about what you just mentioned, the quality of the access issue, speed, then it's a different question. Again, maybe it's a primitive way of looking at it, but if you take an issue the way it's been handled in this country as far as, for example, medicine and clothes, for some reason we're all paying attention that everybody's entitled to medical care. But if we go to really mushy issues and think that everybody's entitled to have some clothing on their back, the clothing industry has successfully handled that issue where medical has not. And I suspect because medical industry has a lot more regulation than clothing industry. Now, coming back to the same, again, it's difficult to compare, but in TV industry, in my opinion, you know, PBS was not a successful venture just because they're basically doing the same thing regular television, except they're supported by the government dollars.
Sorry, they're doing the same thing.
As a commercial television, they said they have the same company who supports them, except instead of advertising perhaps a product, they advertise the name of the company or whatever, which is not enough of a difference from my perspective. And so regulation, in a sense, hasn't worked and has failed somewhat because they're doing the same thing except putting a gun to my head. As far as the, and telling me to pay for it because I don't have a choice. As far as you mentioned, you know, accessibility issues and telling the, you know, localities to they give AT&T and Verizon, you know, marching orders to provide more access, it's a bit of a false pretense because what really happens, they're going to pass the cost to us. So instead of paying, you know, $70 of access on DSL, we're going to pay $19. So again, it's a hidden cost that we pay in without being aware.
Mm-hmm. At the end of the chain, we almost always end up paying.
Well, yeah, we don't, but it's the same thing in the sense that, like, it's the same with any socialized system. If I'm going to subscribe to cable and I'm paying that extra bit for someone who otherwise wouldn't be able to get it, then it's the same with socialized healthcare. If I pay more into taxes, then...
But socialized healthcare hasn't worked, and so why would...
It works in some countries. Socialized healthcare.
and there are other models, right? Whether it's municipal wireless or other, I mean, there's all kinds of other models beyond obliging AT&T to provide access.
Yes.
Yeah.
In the municipal model that people still pay for it, but...
They still pay for it, but that's a whole other debate.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is, why do you want to regulate something that works so much better than something that hasn't been regulated by the government, like TV?
Yeah, no, that's a great
question.
And that's sort of at the heart of what we're getting at. Like, is there a need? And if there is a need, is there anything missing? Like, is there something that we need to protect in this area? And that's sort of the question. Are we going to go down the same road as we have through broadcast? And that's really the heart of what
I think
we're
to
going.
Your access question, it's a good point. The majority of people in this country, I think this is probably a fair thing to say, although I don't know the statistic, the majority of people in this country can somehow get access to the internet. A lot of those could be dial-ups, or they could be, you know, free dial-ups, things like that, public libraries. It's not yet at the stage where the access and the familiarity with the technology and the cultural way of consumption is anywhere near the levels of radio or television. For me, I don't have to know anything about how radio works or other than how to turn on the power button and change the channel, and I'm immediately receiving it. But to be an informed citizen consuming what's on the internet is highly complex. And, you know, my grandma has broadband, but I don't think that she has the kind of access that I have to the internet because she doesn't have that cultural knowledge. So,
but the same thing with the radio programs as well. You have to know what to listen to be well informed, as you mentioned.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's not you still have to make decisions, but in terms of sort of the barrier to entry, I think that the internet is right now at a much higher barrier to entry than the other media forms. And you just look at the habits around how people are using media, a vast majority of people are still getting news from television and, well, less so from radio, except for probably NPR and a few select sources. So I think you're right. Over time, it's the shift is changing, but we're not yet at the point where we can say, let's deregulate television and radio completely.
But I wanted to add one thing, is that I agree that people do have access to dial-up, but when we're talking about video and audio, dial-up is really hard. I mean, it takes me like 20 minutes to check my email on dial-up, let alone to watch a video. So
that's a spam issue.
And broadcast television reaches 99% of the population, and broadband, I think, is at like 36 or 38%. If you're going to say that you need broadband in order to watch video on the internet, that's debatable.
Say nothing of creating.
Yeah.
Just really quick, because it's another question related to the intersection of all of this, is the conversion from analog to digital television. Because in a few years, I mean, a lot of people don't even know that when you're talking about over-the-air television, that's all gone in a couple of years. And a lot of people don't know that. It's going to, I think, dramatically, drastically affect a lot of low-income people across the country.
Over-the-air analog television
is
mandated to be discontinued by law.
2009. So this raises a whole, this is like completely at the crux of, you know, should we regulate in the public interest in the digital television environment, and what are appropriate regulations? How should they or should they carry over from over-the-air broadcasts, those regulations? How should they be applied to a digital television landscape when essentially what's going to happen is it's going to be like cable on steroids, because you're going to have, you know, triple the amount of, you know, channels going into the same bandwidth. So that's, I'm just wondering if you're looking at into that in terms of this paper.
We haven't talked much about that. I find that a difficult issue, because 70% of the country subscribes to cable, 15% to satellite. So that leaves 15% who rely purely on over the air. And those would be the people who lose out the most by this transition. In the sense that everyone who subscribes to cable won't even notice that we've changed to digital. I mean, they might notice they've got better reception. But and correct me, Colin, on any of this if I'm wrong or misled. So it's that 15%, and the broadcasters, NBC, CBS, they really, really want that extra 15% of the audiences. And so they keep trucking it out to Congress that they are in the public interest, they provide these valuable resource of free over-the-air television, and I'm a little bit cynical about what they actually do. So to the extent that you think that the commercial broadcasters do provide a public service and that we are all better off by having access to that, and to the extent that you think that people having access to PBS and these things, because they don't get pegged by over-the-air, right? That comes through cable. Then it's like, okay, let's fight to have that portion of the population receive these airwaves and the cost that it incurs on the taxpayer in order to have the spectrum space, which could otherwise be used to other things, maybe municipal wireless. It becomes a spectrum allocation question, which is a really important question and very complicated. Not something we've necessarily gone into about this paper, but we could.
That's a good point.
So, thanks. Oh, okay.
I would find it easiest to follow if I knew from the start, you know, pushing back even further past the PBS or the platform, but looking at the general rules or principles that you want to preserve. But what would be helpful for me would be things like case studies, because one of the questions that comes into my mind is that, you know, things are moving at quite a pace, and then one of the underlying issues is, would you actually want, in an ideal world, even slap all the regulation on there right now? Are there certain things that have to play out? So it seems like, naturally, you're just going to be left with some open questions, but it'd be helpful then to sketch them out in case studies, like picking four or five things. Like, imagine we impose X. Here's what we know about the market now, about use, here's the predictions, and here's what we can see actually happening, because I think, in ideally, that would bring people to the same conclusions that you have through those case studies, and it would be a way of sort of parting the waters through all this abstraction of grounding the paper.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Part of what we hope to do when we do this sort of history of public interest is to look at it through the case studies of early commercial television and what happened there. And you and Susie played that little clip of the Minnow speech, which is the vast wasteland speech, and look at it through the case studies of public broadcasting and PEG access. And then in terms of the sort of multi-channel internet universe, look at a couple of the examples of those emerging technologies, like satellite is a very interesting area that we haven't read as much about yet as we'd like to, but it's interesting from a regulatory perspective. But it's looking like you were meaning something different.
Say, and I think you can still preserve a lot of the subtleties, like the question about access that we were tossing back and forth before. I mean, a lot of people had access to the internet but didn't log until applications made it easier to log out. So access is a first step, but it's clearly not the paved road, you know? And so I think teasing apart issues to show the complexity in such a way that, I mean, the internet is different than these other mediums. I think preserving that
Mm-hmm.
Would be, I mean, I guess it depends on what audience you're also
for. Well, if you're up for it, we should continue the conversation after, actually.
Can I throw one other thing out there?
There's a couple people online who haven't had a chance.
Great.
Yeah, so.
Thanks. It's good that I follow this, because I just wanted to give sort of like a brief history lesson, because I don't think there's really anybody in this room who can remember when there wasn't television. And my grandparents talk about when they got the first television and there wasn't the access that we all just are sort of assuming that there is that there was one person on the block who had the television and everybody went there, and in essence, it was really sort of a hotspot. And then, yeah, and if you watch old movies, you see people listening to John F. Kennedy give his inauguration speech. They're all standing in front of the appliance store, which is like a really primitive form of a hotspot, or a T-Mobile hotspot. So I think you're at the very beginning of trying to figure out, and that's why maybe it took the 60 years for the federal government to say, maybe there needs to be, you know, a corporation public broadcasting or a PBS station that has no, because it took them that long to ramp up the access, because there seem to be two tracks we're talking about here, which is ramping people up so that you can get something that's current, that you can see this open pipe that you want, but you also have to get the, you have to get the content, you have to get the pipes, and we're still back where we were in like 1994. And I kind of wanted to throw that out, because I think we're all taking it for granted that everybody's got a radio and everybody's got television, but there was a time when you had to go somewhere to get that technology as well, and it was also that, you know, continually getting obsolete with black and white coloring out of HDTV and digital. So there are people still getting left behind in this old media. So we can't really expect immediate ramp up in new media.
Yeah, no, that's a great point.
The phrase I've been grasping for in this, I think I might have come up with it, public advocacy video has in several interesting cases not even has been distributed by the U.S. Post Office, and specifically I'm thinking of the Robert Greenwald efforts, the Fox News movie and the Walmart movie, and there was a movie, short-lived because DeLay was indicted, but a movie about DeLay, and there have been a number of really interesting attempts at public advocacy video that I guess by genre should belong in the PBS sphere, maybe. But I'm wondering, does the Greenwald type of effort tell you anything about the success and failure, the past and future of the next generation?
I think probably I don't know too much about the resources that were put into those, but my understanding is that in a lot of cases, those movies would have not been possible without lowered cost of production. And I know, for example, in the Fox case,
access to a massive array of DVRs and digital archives of things like that, and the ability to burn DVDs. And although they're being sent in the mail, not over the internet, you could imagine them being sent over the internet today or reasonably in 5 years or so. Uh-huh. So my very high level thought on that is, I think what that tells us is that these enabling technologies are, again, it's sort of the theme of lowering the barrier. And it may be lowering the barrier to an extent that we don't need a monolithic separate agency to coordinate and invest and find the expert producers to do it, but rather it happens as a more distributed thing. Is that along the lines of what you were asking?
I'm curious about how you feel that this kind of effort informs you, because obviously they went outside of both conventional TV and the internet, but they were able to make a go of it. Al Gore, Inconvenient Truth, he chose another way. He went had the clout or the PR value to go straight to the movie theaters. Again, no internet really, maybe a little publicity, no TV.
It's a good reminder that these sorts of things, I mean, this effort has existed since before the internet. The internet didn't invent media advocacy. But certainly, I learned about the Al Gore movie over the internet. I watched the trailers. On archive.org, I watched a speech that he'd given in 2004 because I was interested in it. In terms of the Fox News, I originally learned about it because I was reading a blog that had posted a video clip, and I went to their website and read more about it. So even though the direct distribution is not happening in those particular cases through the internet, I think that the sort of interconnection and community conversation that's happening around those sorts of efforts is enabled by the internet in a unique way that wasn't possible before. But
just kind of a question about content quality, and when it's interesting that PBS was kind of started as a way to improve content quality. And so when you're talking about transferring that model to the internet, have people kind of looked at, done like a survey of the, I mean, it's very subjective, and you know, this would be very difficult, but the content quality of the internet. You know, a lot of times people talk about user-created content and YouTube and things, but you know, if you go to YouTube and you look at the top 100 videos, you know, I'm not sure if that would be like public interest material. You know, it's more like America's Funniest Home Videos. And I think that's changing. You know, there are a lot of like these do-it-yourself networks that I've seen popping up online where people make a video about how to play guitar chords and kind of something you might see on like public access. But I just wonder, has anybody kind of looked at and really compared to the quality, you know, the example of user-created content you often hear is the Backstreet Boys lip sync thing. And I always think, yeah, that's, you know, it's entertainment, but is that really like replacing kind of this other? I don't know really how to categorize it. It's difficult, but.
There's two thoughts I have out of that, and I think absolutely that's a point and sort of a criticism that surfaces. Going to something Amanda said earlier about the investigative journalism and the resources required to actually do a thorough production and really research and have people out in the field getting material and checking their sources and making sure it's accurate. There's questions of quality and accuracy and all of that. So absolutely, I think there's a role, and that sort of goes back to the PBS of the internet. Do you need some sort of funding in order to maintain or create high quality content on the internet? The second thing is the role of a moderator, which I find really interesting when you see the mass and the many-to-many collide, and you have something like NBC deciding that, ooh, we're going to have a contest, and the best one we're going to air on our bullhorn. And it's similar to current TV saying, you know, here's the instructions, create your own video, and if we like it, we're going to air it again on our bullhorn. And that's sort of where the editing and moderating function of someone sifting through and deciding, as opposed to the pure technology search function where you search a tag and come up with, the top 100 hits. But yeah, I think that's an important distinction to be made.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see the hybrids where the quote-unquote old media and the new media intersect and play on the strengths of each. Susie's bullhorn analogy, you know, broadcast. So I work for an organization that helps in very quick summary, we help a lot of different audio producers get their stuff on radio stations across the country through the internet. And when their piece is licensed and aired on a radio station, that represents potentially millions of listeners. Versus, you know, on the internet, you really have to aggregate a lot of audience before it can get anywhere close to that. You have to spend a lot of effort doing that. So the marriage of the different technologies is really interesting. So, anyway, sorry.
I don't want to be the last, okay?
Last bit that in there.
I agree with you. I think that access is probably going to be paramount in the coming years. That being said, one comment on content is that PBS creates content, but they also implicitly say that this is good public content. Mm-hmm. And I guess an open question is, what happens if you find that there's adequate good public content on the internet? Does a role be created for a government entity or some kind of quasi-government entity to say, this is good, we like this, that's crap.
No,
that's a different world.
There's absolutely a paternalistic element of PBS in deciding what's good for us. And there's pushback, and I think that's one of the reasons why sometimes it's politically unpopular. Because people don't want to be, you know, fed shredded wheat for breakfast kind of thing and told that it's good for them whether they agree with it or not. What I find really interesting about PBS is that it's, and I don't mean to be harsh or anything, but it's supposed to be diverse, and it's supposed to be showing us about representing different sort of populations in the country and voices that aren't on commercial television. But I read on the website the other day claiming that, do not be alarmed, there is no HIV-positive character on Sesame Street. And I was like, it didn't say do not be alarmed, but that was sort of the tone of the note. And this is only in South Africa because AIDS is a huge problem in South Africa. We're not putting an HIV-positive character on Sesame Street. And I thought, this is kind of interesting. That's somebody's decision as to what's in the public interest and what's not. And so they're always, and that's sort of one of the fundamental flaws, when only so many people can decide what programming is in the public interest.
The other thing I just wanted to throw out there was that, I mean, increasingly the behavior of the user is important as more and more information is out there. And it was very safe to send me when I was learning about the Second World War to the library. But I don't think we've figured out how we're going to teach our children how to use the internet. And I don't know where this would go, but I kind of shudder at the idea of the government getting involved in a profound way and telling people how to teach people how to be media savvy.
Yeah. It goes to questions of how do you understand media literacy and the needs for media literacy in the context of all these new media technologies.
Yeah.
We had models for explaining to kids how to deal with libraries and radio and TV to an extent, but it's a very different way of engaging with the media in this model. It's a great question.
Yeah.
My question is about the interest part of public interest. And this is something that I discussed a lot with a lot of people at Beyond Broadcast. And the issue was that NPR, public radio, PBS is kind of a little bit dying out in the coming generation of, you know, the ADD children who just want to watch YouTube videos of people lip syncing and dancing around. Like, the question is, I guess, even if you did create a PBS for the internet, is it plausible to imagine that people will be, like, enough people will be interested, will be, like, motivated to go on there to search for things that are supposed to be public interest, when in fact, you know, generally the public interest is, like, American Idol and, you know, other trashy television? And I guess, how do we generate that interest, especially for, you know, people my generation and younger who don't really have that NPR grounding?
Right. Yeah, and it's a distinction in terms of the term interest as well. You know, there's the public interest. What's in their good? What's in the good of the public? And then what's the public interested in?
There's sort of different theories as to whether you provide the sort of marketplace of ideas, and if you let everyone have a voice, then the truth rises to the top, or you give individuals the autonomy to decide what they want to believe and what they don't want to believe and what they want to hear and what they don't want to hear. That's one model. Another model is sort of this blueprint for society, which is, I think, what you were getting at, and is it the government's role to be deciding what's good for us? But I think one thing you're touching on with the internet is that you don't have the sort of 12 channels that you're flipping among, and one of them is PBS and one of them is PEG, or, you know, now it's 500. But on the internet, where you have so many, why would a 12-year-old spend time on PBS.org as opposed to YouTube? And that's a good question.
Like,
right.
Well, on these very profound questions, I think it was tremendously fitting that we had a great last session, and that this last Tuesday lunch ever at Baker House should be conducted on just these topics as we get ready to move to our new building and our new fancy conference room without microphones that require special assistance moving us around, and with two screens, probably neither of which will have a yellow tint to it. So thank you to all of you, and please join me in thanking Susie and Steve.
You've been listening to a Berkman Tuesday Luncheon with Susie Lindsay, speaking on July 11th, 2006. Audio Berkman is brought to you by the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. For more information, visit us on the web at cyber.law.harvard.edu/audio. For Audio Berkman, I'm Colin Rinesmith. Thanks for listening.